Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. We'll turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Republican American. The date is Thursday, July 11th. USPS's wasteful ways. If the U.S. Postal Service based its pricing policies on the Consumer Price Index rather than whatever it bases its prices on, a first-class stamp would not cost 73 cents, as it will beginning July 14th. Given that a stamp cost 5 cents in 1966, it should cost about 49 cents now. Even basing postage stamp inflation on the 2021 price of 55 cents, a stamp should not cost more than 66 cents in mid-summer 2024. The whatever comes down to this, as articulated by Senator Gary Peters, a Democrat from Michigan, chairman of the Senate's Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. There have been a lot of concerns that people have expressed about delays and inefficiencies. We'd like to get more transparency as to exactly what's happening. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy talked about being on a sounder financial footing now, and I have questions about that. In other words, nobody knows why the USPS cannot control its spending and therefore the costs it imposes on consumers. According to the Post's reporting, Congress forgave $107 billion in the past due and future obligations for retiree health care benefits in 2022. While the USPS relies on user fees, not taxpayer funding, for its operating costs, it did pick up $10 billion in the CARES Act of 2020 and another $3 billion in 2022 to buy electric trucks and charging stations. But since the Postal Service posted a $6.5 billion loss in 2023 fiscal year, and it's on track to lose more than $8 billion in fiscal 2024, which ends on September 30, the Post reported. The agency, according to DeJoy's 10-year Delivering for America restructuring plan, was supposed to break even in 2023 and post a $1.7 billion surplus in 2024. Tellingly, a Postal Service spokesperson declined to comment. Presumably, his or her explanation would have done the agency even more harm in terms of its public image than the disturbing data the newspaper was able to report. What's to be done? Critics have suggested that the service is ossified and in dire need of workplace reforms, Forbes magazine reported in February 2021. According to our analysis, the USPS doesn't enforce a mandatory retirement policy, meaning employees can continue earning top dollars for as long as they wish. Nearly 550 employees have been on the job for at least 50 years, 8,500 for at least 40 years, 76,500 for at least 30 years, and 212,000 for at least 20 years. The Post Office did not respond to our request for comment. The 1997 movie, The Postman, bombed, but its premise that the U.S. Postal Service was and is an essential component to the American way of life remains valid. The Board of Governors of the U.S. Postal Service, Congress, and President Biden's administration need to get their hands dirty and plug the leaks in the agency's budget. It may be that the post office never will be efficient, cost-effective operation. Surely, its wasteful ways can be ameliorated, if not cured. From the Hartford Courant, dated July 11th, by Lisa Rimland. Opinion: seeds of UConn athletic greatness planted long ago. As a student and graduate student at UConn, I had worked at the Division of Athletics for many years, doing just about everything. Tutoring, administrative work, office work, recreation, and home game management. By the time the early 90s or 80s came along, Lynn McCollum, who ran the equipment cage and building security, was talking to me one day in the equipment cage and seemingly out of the blue gave me a key ring with a full set of keys on it. "Can you keep the building locked?" he asked me. I took the keys and from then on was in the field house and the surrounding buildings day and night. I vividly remember what it was like to be in parts of the building where no one else was, hearing the echoes of activity and the cheers of students and fans at basketball games in the old field house. I remember running around the track in the early 1970s, desperately trying not to get in the way of a great pole vaulter who was forever practicing. That's Timothy Coburn of East Hartford. I remember Coach Larry Navoy, who led UConn to a Yankee Conference championship and a victory over Yale, sitting on the white benches that lined the basketball court and watching me run after having completed his daily games of handball in the paddleball courts. But most particularly, I remember my first nighttime encounter with UConn's great athletic director, John Toner, who had been elected president of the NCAA in January 1982. One night I saw the light on in his upstairs fieldhouse office. Being concerned, I walked up the back stairway, entered the office corridor, and walked the length of it. Mr. Toner, having heard someone come in the back door, got up to see who it was. We met in the office corridor. "What are you doing here at this hour?" he asked, shocked to see me. I explained to him that I was now doing 24-hour building security and found out that he had just gotten off the plane from an NCAA meeting and was working the night to catch up. Totally devoted to UConn athletics, this was only one of many nights that he worked to make sure he stayed on top of things while guiding the NCAA. One night recently, I had a dream that I was back in the days of locking up the field house. All the lights were on at a time that they normally should have been off, and the custodial staff was not due in for a while. I entered the court area. A tall, thin man in shorts and a gray T-shirt was running up and down the court making baskets at both ends. I stood for a while but could not identify him. Finally, I realized I was watching a young Dom Perno. I was about to leave when I noticed a very young boy sitting on one of the white benches by the side of the court, his gaze transfixed on the man running up and down the court. In the dream, I then left, but I came again the following night and saw the same scene. And in the nights following, I witnessed the same scenario again and again. Finally, one night, I noticed that the light upstairs in Mr. Toner's office was on. He was working all night again. In the dream, I decided to bring the little boy upstairs to see him. I went up to the bench where he was sitting and asked him to come with me. We went up the back staircase, entered the office, and made our way down to Mr. Toner's office. "Well, who is this?" he asked the little boy. The little fellow remained silent. "Well, let him stay with me tonight. I will look after him and tell him everything about UConn athletics," Toner said. Hours later, I came back to bring the little boy downstairs, and Toner brought him out of his office. "Did he tell you his name?" I asked. "Yes," came the response. "This is Danny." A good friend of mine who earned his doctorate at UConn commented to me recently that he never imagined that UConn could reach such levels of excellent achievement in basketball, and he asked me if I felt the same way. "No," I answered. "I always knew that it was someday possible, because step by step, the seeds of hard work, dedication, and greatness were planted a long time ago. This by Lisa Rimland, who lives in Glastonbury. Opinion: Trump's move to the center is stunningly transparent, by Jill Filipovic in CNN.com. She is a journalist based in New York and the author of the book, Okay, Boomer, Let's Talk, How My Generation Got Left Behind. Former President Donald Trump wants to win the White House back, and that means softening the Republican Party's stated position on abortion rights, even if he and the GOP have no intention of actually following through. Trump's obvious posturing toward the center was evident on Monday when the Republican National Committee's Platform Committee approved a draft that included language apparently moderating the GOP stance on abortion and same-sex marriage. Trump seems to realize that the issue of abortion and other reproductive rights remains his and his party's weakness, thanks only to their own incredible overreach. Trump appointed three conservative justices to the U.S. Supreme Court, all of whom helped to overturn Roe v. Wade and end the national right to abortion in the U.S. That decision has proven disastrous on many levels, especially for women in Republican-run states who continue to suffer the consequences. A strong majority of Americans support abortion rights, and many voters are livid and motivated. This is a big problem for Republicans, although much of the anti-abortion movement remains in denial and has been pushing for more bans and tighter restrictions. The result is that now America finds itself with abortions banned in more than a dozen states, and many of these states have fought court battles to maintain strict laws or enact new ones. Two were even decided, or really punted, by the Supreme Court this year. The GOP seems to want it both ways: strict and wildly unpopular abortion bans that they get credit for from the base, but no political price for the unpopular policies that much of the rest of the country rejects. The 2024 Republican platform has not yet been published, and accounts suggest it is largely shaping up to be a document that does little more than pledge allegiance to Trump and his MAGA politics. That means a lot of vague hand-waving. Trump has never been a politician who is heavy on the policy specifics, or who even mentions more than a few issues. Crime, the economy, and immigration are his go-tos. He boasts about his role in overturning Roe, but doesn't want to take responsibility for the blowback. And so, his strategy seems to be to pen a platform that backs off of abortion extremism. The draft platform suggests that abortion should be an issue left to the states, does not make mention of a national abortion ban, as previous platforms have, and according to the New York Times, claims that the party backs, quote, access to birth control and IVF fertility treatments, unquote. This is indeed a more moderate stance than the GOP has taken in the past. The truth is that the Republicans have had the chance to do all of these things already, and they haven't. If leaving abortion to the states was the plan, why have Republicans pushed for national bans in Congress? Why has Trump suggested he would support a national 15-week ban? Why have Republicans supported laws that would ban not just abortion from day one, but could extend to IVF and many forms of contraception as well? Why, when given the opportunity to vote to protect contraception access, did Senate Republicans refuse? Why, when given the opportunity to vote to protect IVF, did Senate Republicans block the legislation from coming to a vote at all? Why have anti-abortion groups tried to ban the abortion pill? And why have many Republicans not only backed them, but taken it upon themselves to warn pharmacies that sell these pills? Why don't Republicans seem to want to repeal a Victorian-era law that could criminalize abortion pills and potentially contraception as well? The answer is presumably that Republicans don't actually plan on moderating when it comes to abortion. They simply increasingly understand that they need to say the right things to get into office. Trump has given little indication that he cares about abortion rights one way or another, and he has flip-flopped on the issue throughout his life in the public eye. In 1999, he said he was pro-choice in every respect, even though he personally hated abortion. Since his 2016 campaign, it seems he has said whatever he thinks Republican voters want to hear. He backed a national 20-week ban and promised to appoint pro-life judges who he thought would overturn Roe. Earlier this year, he said a 15-week national ban sounded very reasonable. Now he doesn't seem to want to discuss it. Trump also seems to want to distance himself from Project 2025, a plan devised by the conservative group the Heritage Foundation, which aims to drastically reshape the federal government to better support a conservative agenda if Trump should regain the White House. "I have no idea who is behind it," Trump said of Project 2025 on Truth Social. "I disagree with some of the things they're saying, and some of the things they're saying are absolutely ridiculous and abysmal. Anything they do, I wish them luck, but I have nothing to do with them." Trump seems to have discovered that you have to say the right things if you want to be put in power, whether or not you actually plan on following through. He has proved he is not an honest or trustworthy man. So we should assume that what Trump says in order to get elected gives us very little information on what he will actually do in office. The anti-abortion movement seems to understand this better than anyone. Marjorie Dannenfelser, the president of the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, told the New York Times that the mission of the pro-life movement for the next 6 months must be to defeat Biden-Harris' extreme abortion agenda. After that point, she presumably understands Trump can do whatever he wants, including the extreme anti-abortion movement's bidding. The anti-abortion strategy is clear. Claim moderation, while in practice continuing to push radically unpopular and extreme policies. Voters have a choice. We can believe that Donald Trump and his GOP are saying, or we can judge them on what they're actually doing. Joe Pisani, opinion, in the New Haven Register, dated Thursday, July 11th. "My conspiracy theory is that the younger generation is too trusting." I love a good conspiracy theory. Why? Because they're probably true, even though the powers that be work overtime to convince us otherwise. One of the greatest curiosities in modern America is that the younger generation believes everything the government says, everything academia propounds, everything they see on social media, and every utterance of self-proclaimed experts. How did that come about? Remember the good old days when our motto was, "Don't trust the system"? Well, we're finally finding out what happens when you trust the system. But back to conspiracy theories. Some of them just don't die, such as the mystery surrounding the Beatles' White Album and the JFK assassination, not to mention the purported government involvement in the death of Marilyn Monroe. There are tons of conspiracy theories about UFOs, now known as unidentified anomalous phenomena. I hope the government bureaucrat who came up with that verbal monstrosity got a big bonus, because half of the country doesn't have the faintest idea what it means. It probably means there's nothing to see here, folks. And what about conspiracy theories concerning the sinister origins of COVID? From marketplace bats to laboratory rats associated with the NIH. Remember when they said it was the criminal to suggest that it might have come from a lab in China? Social media is filled with conspiracy theories about vaccines. Don't get hysterical. I'm fully vaccinated. Well, almost fully. But I have to whisper now so certain family members don't find out. There are conspiracy theories about election fraud, about who's running the country, about Russian collusion, about collusion between politicians and the media, and of course, about poor Joe Biden. Someone suggested to me the other day that the Democrats should try to get Michelle Obama and Pope Francis on the ticket. Is that even possible? The Pope is 87. Besides, he's not a U.S. citizen, but I bet they could pull some strings to make that work. However, I won't believe it until I see it on CNN. I'm convinced there's one thing all Americans want, regardless of whether they're Democrats or Republicans or independents or simple-minded people like me who believe that politics is not the solution to the problem but the cause. Yes, we all want one thing. To stop the pain. But can people who cause the pain be counted on to stop it? The country is in sad shape. None of us get along, and we don't believe what we're told. I can imagine how Augustine of Hippo must have felt when he saw the Roman Empire collapsing all around him. At least Benedict of Nursia took action and built a monastery in the mountains, where the monks could hide out. Every election, people like Alec Baldwin and Whoopi Goldberg say that they're going to leave the country. But where can they go? The monastery? Canada, where they're even more confused than we are. My daughter, who lives in Southern California, recently visited and tried to abduct me and take me back with her. She said people in California are friendlier. They're laid back. And they're smarter than the rest of us. I guess that's why so many of them are moving to Texas, so they can enlighten those poor cowboys. Besides, California has too many celebrities for my taste, and the earthquakes worry me because I'm convinced the big one is coming, as Fred Sanford would say. I still have nightmares about that movie, San Andreas, starring The Rock, where California tumbles into the sea, as Steely Dan would say. But at the end of the movie, they all work together to rebuild, which is what we should be doing now. Hey, maybe The Rock should run for president along with the Pope. I don't want to distrust the system, but that's what happens when you watch The X-Files, which I started doing on the advice of an astute reader. That show taught me you can't trust people in power, especially if it involves aliens. Trust no one is the X-Files motto. I don't want to believe our institutions and leaders are prone to lying, deceiving, and conspiring. But I suspect when their sole motivation is holding on to power, they'll do and say anything. I didn't come up with that idea. I think it was Thomas Aquinas or Machiavelli or Jason Bourne. To quote Edgar Allan Poe, a man with a clear vision, if ever there was one, believe nothing you hear and only half that you see. That includes this column, not to mention our political leaders, along with influencers in social media and mainstream media, and those telemarketers calling you with the deal of a lifetime, and those crazy ads on YouTube. What America needs is people who tell the truth, especially when that's supposed to be their job. Trust me, oops, didn't Nixon say that? Let me remind you, just because I have a column doesn't mean I know what I'm talking about. However, since you made it to the end, I'll reward you with some good old-fashioned, unadulterated truth that came from the lips of my mother. Some people lie for a living, and they usually have a lot of co-conspirators. Can I get an amen? This from former Stanford advocate and Greenwich Time editor Joe Pisani, who can be reached at joepisani@yahoo.com. the talented Democrats who aren't running for president. July 9th by Mara Gay in the New York Times. She's a member of the editorial board. At a barbecue for a Biden-Harris event, a small crowd of Democratic voters gathered recently for a quiet lunch in the parking lot of a Detroit church, where a swift Michigan wind carried away their polite applause. At one table, a member of the United Auto Workers, the state's powerful automotive union, told me that voting for President Biden was a duty he planned to perform. Then Representative Jasmine Crockett of Texas grabbed the microphone, and suddenly the listless group of voters came alive. The Republicans remained steadfast as it relates to Roe v. Wade. They didn't take our rights overnight. They worked on it for decades. We need that type of resolve, Ms. Crockett boomed to the mostly black crowd. They want to say things like, you know what, Jim Crow life was better for y'all black folk. No, no, a man shouted. The crowd fell silent, rapt. Ms. Crockett, a powerhouse campaigner, isn't even the most talked about from the Democratic Party's deep bench of rising stars. As she and others continue to hit the campaign trail, the conundrum facing the party becomes clearer. There is plenty of political energy within the Democratic base, but it may not be there to reelect Joe Biden. The dynamic is an awkward one. For months, Mr. Biden relied on this charismatic group of Democrats to serve as surrogates. In the wake of his disastrous debate performance, it is increasingly difficult for voters to ignore the bevy of charismatic politicians outshining the standard bearer they are trying to publicly defend. In the days since the debate, Ms. Crockett, a criminal defense and civil rights attorney, has built a case for Mr. Biden that, though not inspiring, feels more honest than anything the president or his closest aides have come up with. If we're looking for somebody who's going to go out there and put on a good dance for us, probably not, she said of Mr. Biden in a phone interview. If that's what you need of your presidential candidate, then probably not. But if you're looking for someone who has a mind and a heart that is set on policies that will be life-changing for regular, everyday, middle-class people, then yeah. Immediately after the debate, Governor Gavin Newsom of California was among the Democrats scrambling to turn the attention away from the president's poor performance and return the focus to Mr. Trump. There is also Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, who supported a successful ballot initiative to enact abortion protections and who enjoys a roughly 61% approval rating in a politically fractious swing state, where a local militia plotted to kidnap her. Most talked about, though, is Vice President Kamala Harris. For many of Mr. Biden's term, the White House sidelined Ms. Harris, treating her as a liability. Over the past year, she has grown stronger as a speaker and campaigner. Well, that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. I've been reading from the editorial and the opinion pages of the New Haven Register, the New York Times, CNN.com, the Hartford Current, and the Republican American. I'm Larry Rifkin. So long. Until next time.